The vampire must have a host, active and strong, to house its egg until it could be passed on, and it remembered the shape and nature of its first host. As you know, father, my other father, the source of my egg, was a wolf. I knew that my body was going, my mind too. I saw that I was reverting. But still, there was someone who knew my story, all of it, from the day I was conceived, and to whom I could talk in my hour of need. My mother, of course, and in practicing my dead speak, so I kept at least that one last talent alive. But as for the rest, they are gone, forgotten. Ironic. I destroyed your talents and lost my own. And now when I forget things, I talk to the gentle one under the stones, whom reminds me of what has been, who even reminded me of you when I might so easily have forgotten.
Harry's emotions, the gigantic emotions of the Vampiri, had filled him to overflowing. He couldn't find words to speak, could scarcely think. In a few short hours, the smallest fraction of his life, his entire life, had been changed forever. But that meant nothing. His pain was nothing, for others had really suffered, and were suffering even now, and he could trace it all back to himself. Son!
I'll come here no more,
the dweller said.
Now that I've seen you, and now that you've forgiven me, I can forget what I was and be what I am, which is something you might try for yourself, father.
He reached out a hand to touch Harry's own trembling hand, and his forearm was grey furred where it slid from the sleeve of his robe. Harry turned his face away. Tears were unseemingly in scarlet, vampiry eyes. But a moment later, when he looked again, the dweller's robe was still fluttering to the floor, while a shape, grey-blurred, launched itself from the window. Harry leapt to see. There, in the vampire mist, his son sprang away, then paused, turned and looked back. He blinked triangular eyes, lifted his muzzle, sniffed at the cold air. His ears were pointed, alert. He tilted his head this way and that. He was listening. But to what?
Someone comes,
he barked warningly, and before the necroscope could question his meaning,
ah, yes, that one, forgotten until now, like so many other things I've forgotten. It seems I'm not the only one who marked your return, father. No, for she too knows you're back.
She? The necroscope repeated his werewolf son, as that one turned and loped for the higher peaks, and all the grey brotherhood with him vanished into the mist. Then a shadow fell on the dweller's house, and Harry turned his startled eyes skyward, where even now a weird diamond shape fell towards the garden, and... She? He asked again, his query a whisper. He means me, Hellander. Her telepathic voice, hardly severe, nevertheless exploding in Harry's mind like a bomb, reached down to him. Telepathy, yes, and not deadspeak. But how could this be? It whirled him like a top. You? He finally answered in her own medium as her flyer swooped to earth. The long dead, the no longer dead, the undead Lady Karen. Chapter 3. Harry and Karen, the threat of the Icelands. Karen glided her flyer to earth at the north-facing front of the garden, just beyond the low wall there, where the ground sloped steeply away towards Starside. It was a good relaunch site and well known to her, for this was where she'd blinded the crazed Lesk the Glut, cut out his heart, and given his grotesque body to the garden's defenders for burning. Leaving the dweller's old house and making his way towards her through the dispersing mist, the necroscope sent a dazed thought ahead of him. Is it really you, Karen, or am I seeing and hearing things? I mean, how can this be real? I saw you dead and broken on the scree, where you'd thrown yourself down from the roof of your eyrie. Huh? She answered, and without malice. But that was when you were seeing things, Harry Keogh. She had stepped through a break in the wall and stood poised there, waiting for him, silhouetted against the wall and flyer both. The latter, a nightmare dragon thing, but harmless for all its prehistoric design, nodded, salivated, and blinked huge owlish eyes. It swayed its flat spatulate head this way and that. Its damp gleaming manta wings were of fine flexible aviolate bone, thinly sheathed in metamorphic flesh. Worm legs or thrusters bunched beneath the doughy bulge of its body. Harry looked at it and wondered why he felt no horror and very little of pity, for he knew that the thing had been fashioned from the flesh of trogs or travellers. Perhaps there was no more horror left in him, or perhaps there was no more human, except drawing closer to Karen, he knew that some of his emotions at least were still human. She was breathtaking. In the world beyond the sphere gate, the world of men, now an entire universe away, her like had been quite unknown. Even her crimson eyes seemed beautiful now. Harry was awed by her beauty, stricken by it no less than when he'd first seen her, that time when she came here to join the garden's defenders in defiance of the Vampiri. She had enthralled him then and did so again now. He couldn't take his eyes off her. He drank her in, from the burnished copper of her hair down through the every gorgeous curve of her body, which, whether half hidden or half exposed, was always given emphasis by its sheath of soft white leather, to the pale leather sandals on her feet, open at the toes to show her toenails painted gold. She was ravishing. Over her shoulders she wore a cloak of black fur, and above her waist a wide black belt whose grey metal buckle was shaped into a snarling wolf's head. The sigil's significance was lost in the past. Dremel Doomsbody's ancestors had passed it down to him, and he in his turn had passed it to Karen. And not only his crest, but Dremel had given Karen his vampire egg too. Riveted for long moments by her weirdness, her unearthly beauty and contrasting colours, Harry had paused. Now he moved closer. Face to face, Karen was even more beautiful, more desirable. Countering his approach, shifting her body to mirror his every move, she displayed the sinuous motion of a gypsy dancer, which he remembered so well. But of course, for upon a time she'd been a traveller. Why, only listen, and he might hear the chime and jingle of her movements. Yes, even when there was none to hear. He heard these things now, and then her telepathic voice chiming in his mind. "You very nearly killed me once, Harry. And I should warn you, my first reason for coming here was to return the favour." She brought forward her right hand until, now hidden behind her back, her battle gauntlet was in position. When she flexed her hand, a torturous delight of blade, hooks and small scythes gleamed silver in the starlight. Harry conjured a Mobius door on his immediate right and fixed it there. Invisible, it was the perfect bolt hole if such was needed. Let Karen take a swing at him, he'd merely feign right and disappear. But these were thoughts he must keep to himself, while out loud, "Are you saying you're here to kill me?" To which, in a voice that trembled at the very edge of her control, she answered in kind, "And are you saying you don't deserve it?" Still keeping his own mind guarded, Harry looked into hers and saw the furious passions brewing there, saw anger bordering on rage, but nothing of hatred. Also, and very important, he saw the Lady Karen's loneliness. They were two of a kind now. "I didn't understand what it was like to be..." he began and paused and tried again. "I mean, I thought I was helping you, curing you, as of some vile disease. But I admitted I did it for my son as much as for you. For if I could cure you..." "Cure?" she spat the word out. "Why don't you try curing yourself? This is no cure, Necroscope. Surely you must know that by now." He nodded, took a chance and inched closer yet. "And, yes, I do know," he answered. "But in a way I did cure you. You had a vampire in you, the sort the Vampiri called a mother. If you had spawned so many vampires, in the end it must diminish you, kill you. Am I right?" We'll never know, will we?" she growled. Harry stood directly before her, less than a pace away, well within the arc of her gauntlet. "So you came to kill me," he said. "But surely you can see I've suffered my own change. And surely you know in your heart that I was never your enemy, Karen. I was merely innocent, in my way." She stared hard at him for a moment, narrowed her eyes a little, and then nodded and smiled. But it was more a sneer than a smile proper. "I've found you out," she said. "I sense your door, Harry. You took me there once, remember? You carried me from the garden to my eyrie, all in a moment, and now there's another door right here beside you. Would you dare stand so close without it? If so, then do it. Show me how innocent you are." He shook his head. "That was then," he said. "As for now, whatever I might wish to be, I can only be Vampiri. Precious little of innocence is in me now, about as much as there is in you. Yes, the thing within advised me to conjure a door, for my protection, or for its protection. But the man which I still am tells me I don't need this safeguard, that it makes anything I might say to you, the things I want to say to you, a mockery. And while I live, the man in me has the upper hand, so be it." He threw caution to the wind, collapsed the Mobius door, and opened his mind wide to her. In a few moments she read or scanned all that was written there, for he kept nothing hidden. But in telepathy, to read is often to feel, and most of all she felt his pain. As great as and greater than her own, and his loss, all his losses, whose total was so much more. And she saw how lonely and empty he was, which brought her own loneliness and emptiness into proper perspective. But she was a woman and remembered certain things. As his right hand closed in the curve of her waist, at first gentle, then positively, so she bent her elbow at his side until her open gauntlet leaned loosely against his back and upper left arm. And she said, "Do you recall the time I told you how I lusted after you? In how many ways I lusted after you? Like a woman, perhaps, but certainly like a vampire. And do you remember when you trapped me in my room, how I tried to lure you? I went naked, writhing, panting, thrusting at you. And you ignored me. It was as if your flesh was iron and your blood ice." "No," he husked in her ear, drinking in the natural musk of her body, drawing her to him and bending down his head to her. "My body was flesh and my blood was fire, but I had set myself a course and must run it. Now it's run." She felt his need swelling to match, to intensify her own. So much need, and was aware of his heartbeat like a hammer against her breast. "You're a fool, Harry Keogh," she whispered, as he crushed her even tighter. And every nerve of her body thrilled as Vampiri instinct demanded that she scoop her gauntlet into the flesh and bone of his back and spoon it out, then reach inside and slice his heart to a crimson-pumping geezer. Thrilled, yes, and thrilled again, in astonishment, when she relaxed her hands so that the weapon fell from her fluttering fingers, fell loose to the ground. "Even as great a fool as I am," she moaned then, sinking red-painted razor-sharp nails through the cloth and skin and shivering flesh into his back and neck, as he in turn wrenched her sheath dress apart and clutched her bruisingly wherever his hands could reach, and bit her face and mouth until the blood flowed. "Which is to say," she panted, when finally they held each other burning at bay, "a very great fool indeed." They flew to her eyrie, mounted behind her in the ornate saddle at the base of the flyer's neck, where its manta wing sprouted. Harry must cling to Karen or risk falling, in which case he would conjure a door and fall through it into the Mobius continuum. But he would not fall while he fondled her straining breasts, whose nipples were nuggets under her ruined sheath. And he would not fall while his manhood strained in the crevice of her delicious behind, surging there as if to lift her out of her seat. "Wait," she had told him, back there in the garden, at the wall, where, with his newfound Vampiri passions, he would have taken her immediately and ploughed her like a field of yielding flesh. And, "Wait," she repeated twice during the flight, when he'd moaned louder than the wind in her ear and bitten the back of her neck, and she had felt his metamorphic flesh flowing to enfold her while his hands enlarged and flattened, as if to touch all of her at once. And yet again, "Wait! Oh, wait!" she had pleaded with him, when the flyer set them down in a launching landing bay, some levels lower than her topmost apartments, and she had almost to flee before his lust across the cartilage causeways and up stairways of fretted bone to her rooms. But at last he caught her in her bedroom and knew that the waiting was over for both of them. Harry had made love so recently, yet now it was all forgotten, and perhaps not surprisingly, for if space and time are so linked as to be inextricable to any ordinary man, just how long ago was it since he had known Penny? A dimension ago? An entire universe? And as a universe is huge almost to infinity, how then the time gap between universes? Time is relative, as the necroscope knew only too well, but in any case, that earlier phase now seemed fuzzy as a dream, while now was the only reality. Penny had been a mirage, a dream creature, a waif light as thistledown, enthralled and drawn into his dream with him, and at last destroyed by it. But Karen was woman. She was substantial, compelling, consuming, a magnet with gravity of her own, great as a small planet, so that she held him like a moon to light her flesh and lust after it. For Harry, she was the embodiment of all earthly, unearthly desire. Greater than a mere planet, she was his own personal black hole, which might suck him in his entirety. Indeed, Karen was all of this and more. Karen was Vampiri. Upon her bed they twined and tangled, panted and grunted and groaned, and in all truth Harry no longer knew what was real and what was fantasy. He had not previously explored his metamorphism. He didn't know the extent of fleshly flexibility. He was innocent in respect of his own passion's potential, and Karen too, innocent, or very nearly so. "You have kept yourself to yourself," the necroscope gaspingly inquired of his vampire love, while extending a hand and its fingers within her to examine and caress all of her innermost organs and places, and while she moistened with spittle the shining fist which was his gland and taunted its throbbing with the slither of her forked tongue. "No," she groaned truthfully. "Twice I flew to Sunside at sundown to seek me out a lover. But how may one seduce a terrified man? Anyway, I brought one back here. In a little while he overcame something of his fear and crept into my bed. Ah, I was a yawning chasm, an aching gorge, into which he dropped a pebble. He could not fill me. I milked him dry and wanted more, but all he had left was blood. I knew that I could grind him down, turn him to pulp, murder him within the heart of my womanhood, and devour him into myself as easily as eating him. But I took him back to Sunside. Since when I've kept me to myself, yes. Just as men and women are for each other, so we Vampiri may only cleave unto Vampiri flesh. For there's no pleasure in beasts, and when Vampiri blood is up, humanity is frail." "All true," gurgled the necroscope, feeling her left nipple extend into his throat like a tongue, while his scrotum swelled to bursting from the pressure of his juices. "A woman would die in agony from what I have done to you." "Likewise a man from these caresses of mine," she replied, shuddering. "But a pleasure, however monstrous," and she drew out his great soft spider-crab hand from her body, folded his legs at the knees and fed them into herself, until finally he was drawn into his navel, and she experienced the geysering of his cold semen lathing her palpitating innards. "And yet the old lords in their time took traveller women for themselves," Harry panted in his delirium. She was full of him now, her pale belly round and shining, grotesquely bloated where his arms and hands encircled it, and her body had so gorged on him that he looked half-born. She coiled herself forward to kiss him, and their teeth clashed as the flesh of their faces melted into one face. A moment later she extruded him in a huge contraction, but just as quickly he entered her again, head first this time, so that she must speak to him telepathically to answer his query.
"Those women die screaming," she said. "I've heard it said that following a raid, Lesk the Glut would take 10 or more in a night, bursting them like bladders with his sex. Ah, that was violation. But the so-called lords weren't all alike. If a girl was beautiful, then she might survive. Brought on by degrees, she would be vampirized, and as her metamorphosis progressed, so her satyr lord would instruct her. The Lord Magula fashioned himself a huge mound of a woman and slept within her when their excesses exhausted him."
She expanded herself convulsively to let him out, then fell on him and grasped at his slick body with exploratory hands of her own. The vampiric equivalent of talking dirty had incensed them. What orifice could be entered of each of them, each entered. Their kisses fetched blood, their juices drenched the bed and dripped from it onto the floor all around. They themselves flopped damply from the bed, slipping and sliding in their own liquids. Harry's system endlessly manufactured semen, which was endlessly sucked from him by Karen's various lips. They let their vampires run rampant. Scythe teeth nibbled, but never so deep as the bone, and nails like claws of Tyrannosaurus pulled and gouged, but only to bruise and never to break. They reduced the bedclothes to drenched rags, the slate bed itself to rubble, the huge room to a shambles. Their love-making, lust-making, grew frantic and impossible to follow in its contortions and convolutions. Their cries became primal as their bodies shared totally. They knew sex as no other human beings had ever known it. The necroscope's greatest climax of many was when Karen entered him. For 15 hours they spent themselves, vented, tormented, and demented themselves, so that in the end they didn't merely sleep, but fell unconscious in each other's coils. When Harry came out of it, Karen was washing him. "Don't," he said, feebly trying to push her away. "A waste of time. I want you again now, while you're still here."
"Still here?"
She took his member in her hand to cool its bruises with water and watched it grow there like a club.
"It's a dream, Karen, a dream," he gasped, his hand seeking her softness. "Like everything's gone before, dreams of a madman. I know it now for sure, for I saw you lying dead. Yet here, now, you live. Unless, is there a necromancer in Starside?"
She shook her head, drawing back from him a little, where his hands began to pull with some insistence at her once more entirely human breasts. And,
"It were best if you listened to me, Harry," she said. "I wasn't dead that time. It wasn't me you saw lying there, broken in the bony scree."
"Not you?
Then who? Do you remember when you starved me?"
Karen stared hard, earnestly, even accusingly at him.
"Do you remember how you lured my vampire out of my body with a trail of pig's blood? Ah, but I was vampiry and crafty. The mother creature inside me was crafty, more so than any other. She, it, left an egg in me. The tenacity of the vampire, Harry."
"You? You were still vampiry?" His mouth had fallen half open.
"Even after I burned your vampire and its eggs?" "You burned all but one," she insisted, "which remained in me. The thing would grow again, yes, but I knew that if you suspected as much, then you'd try again, and then that I would die. Oh, and the thought of that terrified me."
"I remember how I slept." Harry licked dry, almost desiccated lips. "I was even more exhausted than now, by what I'd seen and done."
"Yes," she said. "You fell asleep in a chair, which was when I was saved, for while you slept, one of mine returned to the eyrie."
"One of yours? A creature?" Harry frowned. "But they were all destroyed or sent away."
"Sent away, yes," she answered. "You had sent this one free out of the goodness of your heart, sent her away to die."
"Her?"
"A trog handmaiden, a creature who performed menial tasks within the eyrie and in my personal chambers.
But she had been born here and understood no other existence, and eventually she returned to the only home she'd ever known. I knew it the moment she set foot on the bottom step of the nethermost stairwell. She heard my mind call and came as fast as she could. But she was starved from her wandering in the cold wilderness of Starside, and wearied until death by her climb through all the eerie levels. Even until death, I...
She died? Harry felt Karen's small sadness, as at the death of a favourite pet.
The vampire lady nodded, but not before she'd removed the silver chains from my door and disposed of the potted niblash plants. Then she collapsed and died, and I saw my chance. While still you slept, I dressed her corpse in my best white dress and bundled it from the ramparts. She fluttered down, down, almost as if she flew, but in the end she rushed to the rocks and was broken. This was what you saw when you looked down from that high balcony, Harry. But me, I was hiding, where I stayed until you were gone from here.
The necroscope saw it all now. I went back to the dweller's garden, he said. My son knew what I'd done. Fearing for all his own existence, he took my powers from me, then transported me back to my own world, where for a time I was only a man. But I discovered monsters there, and they discovered me. Until, as you can see, in the end, I set myself against one vampire too many.
Karen had settled down between his spread legs. Despite the seriousness of their discussion of past events, Harry's shaft pounded there like a second heart, where her fingers teased the shining rim of its bell. She paused a while to moisten its pulsing tip with her snake's tongue, and to trap its swaying trunk between her breasts. And,
"How strong you are, Harry," she sighed, perhaps wonderingly. "Indeed, I do believe you're full again."
"To see your face," he answered, "to smell your body and feel you wet in your core, how could I be other than full again?"
He lifted her up to seat her on his rod, and instead she slipped from his grasp and stepped down from the bed.
"Not here," she panted.
"Oh?"
"There," she said.
"There?"
"In that secret place of yours?"
"The Mobius Continuum? To make love there?"
"Why not? It is a holy place."
Harry didn't answer, but it could well be. It could well be.
"Will you take me there, Harry? And will you take me, fuck me there?"
"Oh, yes," he answered throatily. "And I'll show you a place you just won't believe, where we can fuck for a second or a century, as you will."
She flew into his arms, and he rolled her out of the sheets and into the Mobius Continuum.
"But there is no light," she hissed, opening her legs wide and guiding him into her.
"I need to see you, the way your face quakes when you come, the slackening of your mouth as the throbbing subsides and the aching starts."
"You shall have light," he grunted, nodding, and in the next moment felt a deadly fear, for that he had been close to blasphemy. But he had not intended it. She would have light, yes, blue light, green and little red. And as she clawed at his buttocks and rode his bucking, whipping piston shaft, so he foamed within her and carried her moaning through a future time door. And now she saw the future racing away from her and the scarlet light streaming from her own body with only the faintest trace of blue. Indeed, Karen's light mingled with Harry's, twining even as their bodies twined, and his was only slightly less red than hers.
"Our lifelines," he told her. "We ride them into our future."
And then, quoting Faithor, "We ride there faster than life."
"We ride each other into the future," she answered, thrilling to the starburst sensation of it, and to the shock of Harry bursting inside her. And in a little while,
"The blues."
"The travellers," he told her, "the true human beings."
"Then the handful of reds can only be the Vampiri, survivors in the Icelands, and the greens must be Trogs.
I never saw such colours, such light. Even the brightest auroras over the Icelands were never as bright as this."
Harry plied her breasts like dough in his hands and came yet again, and she felt his seed spraying inside her inner walls and shuddered to its gush.
"Your cum is cold as a waterfall."
"No, it's hot, but cool against your insides, which are a volcano."
"It only feels that way," she moaned,
for in truth we're both cold, Harry. Both of us.
We're Vampiri, he answered, but we aren't undead. We've never been dead, not in the way some vampirized people die and sleep a while before their rebirth from the grave. I had expected to be cold, certainly, expected to feel the lust of the Vampiri, their raw, roaring appetite for life and for all dark, carnal experience, but with nothing of the enduring emotion. But this is much more than that, other than that.
For you, perhaps, she answered, for you're not long a vampire, and yet, maybe you're right, this isn't as I imagined it. The old Vampiri were liars, as anyone knows. Could it be that they lied about this, too? Incapable of love, they said, but were they? Or merely incapable of owning up to it? Is it weak to love someone, Harry? And is it strong to be cold and withhold love?
He welded himself to her, all of his parts melting into hers. Cold, he growled. Well, if we're that cold, then why is our blood so hot? And if we're that weak, then why do I feel so strong? No, I think you've got it in one. The last and most blatant lie of the Vampiri, that they were without love. They weren't. They were merely afraid to admit it. And the necroscope knew at last the truth of the matter was exposed. The Vampiri had always been capable of dark passions, desires, and deeds beyond the human range. But now, on the same far side of the spectrum, he and Karen had discovered, in themselves, genuine, equally powerful bonding emotions. And letting those emotions rule could only properly be described as ecstasy. However sudden, weird, and alien their love, they were true lovers. There was a lust in it, of course, but was there ever a love affair between man and woman without lust? As a single fused mass, the first half-human couple ever to cleave to one another in the fullest sense of the word, they sped down the future time stream until out of nowhere, suddenly, a new light. Golden fire, incredible, bursting, all-consuming. At first, Harry thought it was some strange and wonderful effect of their sex, their love, but it was more than that. The great throbbing one-note, chorus of the future, which was not sound at all as such, but the mind's reaction to a three-dimensional display of ever-expanding time, changed in the space of a single moment to a fiery hiss. And the necroscope brought their headlong rush to an abrupt, tumbling halt. Partly extricating themselves, but still mainly fused, they spun on an axis of their own while time rushed on, and Karen, temporarily blind, sank needle claws into Harry's shoulders to gasp, "What was that?" But the necroscope, even Harry Keogh, had no answer. As his own eyes adjusted to the golden brilliance and his mind to the sear and the sizzle, so he glanced back at what had been, like looking into the heart of an exploding blue star where chemical imbalances caused red and green imperfections. But there, all was as before. But up ahead, in future time, Harry's and Karen's threads of life were no longer red, but bright gold, where they rushed out of their bodies into the future. And the future itself was a blaze of gold, tinged with leaping orange flares of fire. Slowly, the brazen yellow glare diminished and faded away, smoking into darkness like embers drenched in rain, and the lifelines of the two vanished within it. Beyond this point, there was no future for them, not on Starside. But there was a future for some, for however dazed, the rest of the blue lines of life raced on, likewise the greens, though there were fewer of them now. But as for the reds, nowhere a sign of them, and the darkness seemed greater than the light.
A disaster? Harry wondered, and Karen heard him. But what happened? What will happen here?
Baffled, he could only shake his head and shrug. The greens seem sickly. They are dying. It was so. A good many Trog lifelines grew dim, flickered low, and blinked out even as they watched. But the necroscope's heart picked up again as he noted that others seemed to gain strength and brightness to speed on, and he breathed a mental sigh of relief as new lines commenced to spark into existence, signifying new births and beginnings. Then He gathered his startled wits, conjured a door, and drew Charon through it into the more nearly normal flux of metaphysical being.
"But what happened?"
She clung to him even tighter. "I don't know," he said, and guided her through a final door, emerging from the Mobius continuum onto the roof of her eyrie. And facing into a cold wind off starside, he added, "But whatever it was, it will happen to be sure." Feeling her shivering where she huddled in his arms, and sensing her despair, he stared inquiringly into her crimson eyes.
"Perhaps I know," she told him then, "for we've sensed their resurgence a while now."
"We?" He allowed her to lead him below, out of the starlight and into the eerie topmost rooms.
"Your son and I," she said, "while he was still himself."
"And their resurgence? Them?" But even asking so, Harry worked out the answer for himself. And now, too, he understood Lardis Lydeski's anxiety and animosity in the Dweller's Garden.
"The Vampiri," she said, "the old lords, condemned to the Icelands, but not content with the Icelands."
They paused through massive, fiercely frescoed halls of fretted bones and carved stone, descended cartilage stairs to her chambers, where they collapsed into great chairs, and in a while...
"Tell me all," Harry grunted.
It had started on Harry's timescale 2 years earlier, which was to say 2 years after the battle for the Dweller's Garden, whose outcome had been the defeat and rout of the old Vampiri lords.
"Sensing a threat from the Icelands," Charon went on, "I requested an audience with the Dweller, during which I confided in him the substance of my fears. By that time he knew well enough that I had survived your cure, but in any case there was a truce between us. After all, I'd fought alongside you and your son against the Vampiri. He could not doubt that I was his ally. Occasionally I would visit him in the mountains, and there were times when he even came to see me here. We were friends, you understand, nothing more. But they were strange times. The change was on him. He was losing human flesh and putting on the shape of the ways of the wolf. And while he retained the minds of a man, he became truly allies a second time. For he too, in his way, had felt the Iceland's threat, a weird foreboding that waxed and waned with the auroras, a doom which crouched there like a beast on the frozen frontier, all hunched down into itself and tensed ready to spring. I have said he sensed it in his way. Your son is a wolf now, Necroscope, with a wolf's sense and instincts. Across all the leagues he could smell them on the winds out of the north, see them riding in the auroras, hear them whispering and plotting their return and their revenge. Aye, their revenge, Harry, on the Dweller and his people, on me, on any and on all who helped defeat them, destroy their eyries and banish them into the great cold. Which is to say on you too, except, of course, you were not here at that time. There was only the Dweller and myself, and going the way he was, it would not be long before I was alone. I asked him what must be done. 'We must set guards,' he told me, 'out there in the cold waste, to look north and report back on any curious incursions from the Icelands.' 'Guards? You must make them,' he said. 'Are you not Vampiri and Dramald Doomsbody's rightful heir? Didn't he show you how?' 'Indeed, I know how to make creatures,' I told him. 'Then do it,' he barked. 'Make warriors, but make them male and female. Make them so they can make themselves.' Self-reproducing? The very idea made me gasp. 'But that is forbidden. Even the worst of the old Vampiri lords would never have dared, would not even consider.' 'Which is why you must do it.' He was forceful. 'Aye, for it will save you time at the vats. Make them so that they can live and breed on the ice, and feed themselves on the great fishes which live under the ice. But build them with a safety device, only 3 whelps to a pair, and all males. After that, they'll die out soon after, but not until they've reported whatever it is that threatens, and done battle with it when it comes rumbling out of the north.'"
Charon shrugged.
"Your son has great wisdom, Necroscope. He knew good from evil, he knew the source of the worst possible evil. But his humanity was failing fast. He knew that when the time came, he would not be able to help me. And so he would help me now, with good advice.
I thought it was good anyway. And in the Icelands? Harry queried.
Scythers? Is it him?
Karen shuddered.
None other, and not alone.
Oh? She grasped his arm.
Do you remember that time in the garden? The fire and thunder, the gas beasts exploding in the sky and raining down their guts, down on everything? The screams of trogs and travellers when vampiry lords and lieutenants came strutting with their gauntlets dripping red?
Harry nodded. I remember all of that. Also how we seared them with the dwellers' lamps, blinded their flyers, set your warriors against theirs, and finally reduced them to vile evaporation with rays from the sun itself.
But not all of them, she said. And Scythus was only one of the survivors. Who else? The giant Fesvarenk and the hideous Volspinisku. Also Arcus Leperson, plus several lieutenants and thralls. None of these were accounted for in the fighting. We must assume they fled north after discovering their eyries shattered and tumbled down in the plain.
The necroscope breathed a sigh of relief. No more than a handful, then? She shook her head.
Scythus on his own would be more than a handful, Harry. Not then, when we had your son and his army to side with, but now, when we have only ourselves. And what of all the other lords banished and driven into the Icelands throughout vampiric history? What if they have survived too? Prior to the battle in the garden, all such went singly, slinking, never in a group. Or they might be allowed to take a woman and the odd thrall with them. Perhaps Scythus and the others have found them and organized them into a small army. But could any army of the vampiri ever be said to be small?
Harry gloomed at her. It could be worse than that. If they took women with them, if they could live with the unending cold, why shouldn't they breed like your warriors? Let's face it, we don't even know what the Icelands are like. Maybe the only thing that kept Icelanders from invading all of this time was the fact that the old vampiri were stronger. But now, there are no old vampiri. Only us, the new vampiri.
Also, she reminded him, out there at the rim of the cold and the sluggish sea, a dozen or more warriors, watchers, guards.
You followed my son's advice and made yourself some creatures?
Yes.
But she looked away.
Out of what? And why did you avoid my eyes?
Karen snatched her head around to glare her defiance at him.
I avoid nothing. I found my materials in the stumps of the shattered eyries, in the workshops of the lords. Most were ruined, crushed, or buried forever, but some were intact. At first I blundered, creating flyers which could not fly, warriors which would not fight, but gradually I perfected my art. You have seen and ridden upon my flyer, an exceptional beast. Likewise my warriors, I made 3 pairs which were sound and fearsome and mighty, who by now have made 6 or even 9 more, except...
And again she turned her face away. Harry caught her chin in a hand and turned it back again. Except?
For a while now they have not answered my calls. I sent my thoughts out across Starside, requesting information, but they don't hear me, or if they do, they fail or refuse to answer.
Harry frowned. You've lost control over them? She tossed her head.
It was something the old vampiri were always afraid of. To make creatures with a will of their own, which might one day bolt and run wild. Mercifully, I heeded the dwellers' warning, and they are doomed genetically. There'll be no females among the offspring.
Harry gave a grunt.
So you have watchers who don't watch, and warriors which won't war.
What other precautions have you taken against this threat from the Icelands? Now she hissed at him.
Do you snigger at my works, Necroscope? And should I tell you how I had decided to meet the threat? When and if it should arise? Remember, before you came I was a woman alone. And how do you think Scythus would deal with me? With Karen, great traitor bitch of the vampiri? If he had survived the Icelands and would now return here, should I surrender myself to his tender mercies? No, not while I could defy him to the last.
Defy him? Lit up in a blaze of her hair and eyes, and in the gleam of her teeth, Harry was struck anew with the thought, she's a volcano inside and out. And out loud, how defy him? Again she tossed her head.
Why, rather than have Scythus force himself upon me, I'd give myself to a more destructive, even more faithless lover.
for I'd mount my flyer and head south, over the mountains and across Sunside, even into the brazen face of the sun itself. Let Scythus chase me there if he would, into the streaming gases and exploding flesh and nothingness. So be it. Harry drew her into his arms, and she came without resistance. It won't come to that, he husked, stroking her hair while her furious tremors subsided. Not if I have anything to do with it. But etched on the mirror of the necroscope's inner mind, kept hidden even from Charon's telepathy, was a scene out of future time, which, try as he might, he could not banish. A picture of a fiery, molten gold future, a vision of the end framed in the scarlet, all-consuming fires of an ultimate hell. Chapter 4. Again, Perchosk. The Icelands now. The hive-like caverns, burnt-out burrows and haunted magmas levels of the Perchosk project had seen a period of intense activity. 6 days since Harry Keogh's night visit with Project Director Viktor Luchov and his subsequent invasion of the core riding a powerful American motorcycle, as a result of which a final terrifying scene had now been set. The pieces were all in place for what Luchov could only hope would be the permanent closure of the gate. Down in the core, standing on the now deactivated, recently cleaned and polished fish-scale plates, where they encircled the dimensional portal, Luchov's unblinking gaze fell in silent awe on the would-be instruments of the disconnection, a pair of top-secret Tokarev Mark II short-range missiles, in most common parlance nuclear exocets, mounted atop the compact, caterpillar-tracked carriage of their grey metal launching and guidance modules. Behind the smoked lenses of his plastic eye shields, the project director's eyes were mere slits, as if frozen in a wince or grimace, for it had been his responsibility, passed down from Moscow, to order the Tokarevs armed and programmed. He knew only too well what he had here, knew that obscene slugs of toxic metal had been loaded into the slender steel bellies of the missiles, where now they lay quiescent but ready on the instant to spring shriekingly awake. All it required was the push of a button. A group of military technicians in white smocks were busy in the vicinity of the Tokarevs, checking and double-checking electrical hookups, semi-automatic and computerized systems, radiation levels, other instrument readings. Their senior man, directly responsible to the project director, touched Luchov's arm and caused him to give a start. Vainly trying to conceal his nervous reaction, the director barked,
"Yes, what is it?"
The man was young, no more than 26 or 27, but already a major. He wore upon his lapels the crown of his rank inside the stylized atomic nucleus insignia of the special artillery arm.
"Sir," he formally reported, "we're already here. From now on, or until these weapons are required for use, there will be 2 of us on duty here, armed, of course, as safeguard against the sabotage. We're aware that the project has a history of, intruders?"
Luchov nodded.
"Yes, very good."
But he'd scarcely been paying attention. Turning jerkily away from the Tokarevs and pointing towards the glaring sphere gate, he said,
"And do you know what you're on guard against? From that, I mean. Are you sure that if ever it's required, you'll know just exactly when to press the button?"
The other stiffened. He knew his duty well enough. A pity he now found himself in a position where he must take orders from a damn civilian, that's all. He was tempted to answer Luchov in just such terms, and from the heart, except it had been made adequately clear to him that the senior scientist was a power in his own right. And so,
"I've acquainted myself with the project's history, certainly, sir," he said coldly. "Also, we've watched all the films, but in any case, the firing sequence may not be initiated except on your instructions."
"Listen," Luchov turned more fully towards him, fixed him with a wide-eyed glare, and grasped his arm in a trembling claw.
"That's your brief, yes, but it doesn't say anything. Indeed, it says very little. You've seen the films? Good, but you can't smell them, can you? They can't spring out from the screen and swallow you whole, can they?"
Nodding wildly and again pointing at the glaring white upper hemisphere of the gate, he continued hoarsely,
"In there, a curse, a plague, something to make Chernobyl seem of no consequence whatsoever. If it, they, whatever, got out into the world, that is the end, I mean, of everything. Mankind joins the dinosaurs, the trilobites, the dodos, gone. So don't get snotty with me when I ask you if you know what you're dealing with."
Pale with barely suppressed anger, the young officer came to attention and his thin mouth cracked open. But Luchov wasn't finished with him, hadn't yet told him the worst.
"Listen," he said again. "One a week ago, a man or something which was once a man went through that gate into whatever lies beyond. When he went, the world breathed a sigh of relief, since when it's been holding its breath, we were glad to see the back of him because he was tainted, a carrier. Now, only now, we wonder, how long before he finds his way back here? And if he does, what will he bring with him? Do you follow me so far?"
Something of the color had returned to the major's face. He sensed the importance of what the project director was saying, the enormous stresses playing on his mind.
"I follow you so far," he said. "Very well," said Luchov. "And now something which wasn't in your brief. You mentioned our previous problem with intruders. Quite right. We did have this problem. We could have it again. So now I'm going to add to your brief and issue a new order."
He pushed his face closer.
"This one. If I should get taken out, if anything weird or inextricable should happen to incapacitate me, or even, yes, exclude me permanently from the scene of things, then you're the next in line. Consider yourself appointed here and now."
"What?" The officer looked at Luchov's pale, shining face, his hideous scarred skull, and wondered if he was entirely sane.
"You are appointing me, Project Director?"
"I am indeed." Luchov was vehement.
"As Guardian of the Earth, yes."
"Guardian of?"
"Press it,"
Luchov whispered, cutting him short.
"If anything should happen to me, press the bloody thing. Don't waste time phoning Gorbachev or those mumbling cretins who so poorly serve him. But press the button. Get it over and done with, and send your exosets on a real mission of exorcism into the world beyond the gate, before the devil himself comes spewing out of there right into your face. Have you got that?"
The major took a pace to the rear. His eyes were very wide now, very concerned, and still Luchov held his arm in a steel grasp.
"Sir, I..."
Abruptly, Luchov released him, straightened up a little, and stiffened his back and shoulders, then glanced away.
"Say nothing."
He gave a curt, almost dismissive nod.
"For a moment, don't say anything at all. But neither must you forget what I said. Don't you dare forget, that's all."
How to answer him? With a smile, which might be misinterpreted? With words? But Luchov had advised him to say nothing, and anyway, the major had no words. Perhaps it were better if he simply forgot the whole incident. Except Luchov had warned him about that too. But anyway, would it be a wise move to forget that this possibly dangerous man was in charge here? And in so doing, to forget what he was in charge of? Saving the major from further embarrassment and possibly worse, a hatch in the fish-scale plates clanged back on its hinges and a maintenance engineer came up from below. Staggering a little as he stood up in the glare of the gate, he wrenched breathing apparatus from his pale damp face and put on plastic goggles. Then he reached out a groping hand as if seeking support and staggered again. Luchov recognized him, went to him at once with the major following on behind.
"Felix Cesani?"
The project director took the man's arm, steadied him.
"Is it you, Felix?"
He could be familiar when he thought the situation required it.
"But you look like you saw a ghost."
The coveralled maintenance man, small, balding, smudged with grime, nodded. He blinked his eyes rapidly and glanced back towards the open hatch.
"The next best thing anyway, director,"
he muttered almost to himself, wiping cold sweat from his brow with a rag.
"What is it?"
Luchov felt the short hairs rising at the back of his neck, which they were wont to do all too often in this place.
"Something below, down there, in one of the sealed shafts, which was part of the original complex, yes.
Cezanne answered.
I was checking a wormhole hotspot. Curiously, the radiation has decreased almost to background. He's no longer dangerous anyway. So I opened up the seal and entered. Eventually, the wormhole came out into the old abandoned reactor maintenance level. In there, I found Magmus, of course.
Ah, now Luchov knew what had happened, or thought he did. There were bodies?
Bodies, yes,
Cezanne answered, nodding.
That was part of it, at least. He'd been roasted, inverted, transformed. Some were half in, half out of the Magmus, like mummies wrapped in warped rock, rubber, and plastic. And even after all these long years of entombment, Lord, still I fancied I could hear their screams.
Luchov was well able to picture it. He had been a scientist here in Perchosk when the hideous accident happened. He still bore the scars, both upon his seared parchment skull and more permanently in his mind, which was why he now shuddered.
It's as well you came out of there, he said. Later you can go down, see the place up again. But for now, I tripped over something.
Cezanne was still dazed, still talking almost to himself, because as yet he hadn't told it all.
Something crumbled into dust where I stepped on it, so that I stumbled and crashed against a cyst, which immediately shattered.
The young major touched Luchov's elbow, but this time very carefully. Did he say something about a cyst? The director glanced at him.
Oh, and are you interested?
And, without waiting for an answer, nodding grimly, he continued.
Then you must see it for yourself.
He called over a private soldier and sent him hurrying off on an errand. And while they waited,
can we borrow a couple of these radiation tags from your staff here?
And then to Cezanne,
Felix, I want you to go and sit on one of those chairs on the perimeter.
And finally to a second soldier,
you there, go and get this man a mug of hot tea, and hurry!
Luchov and the major clipped radiation hazard tags to their clothing. The first soldier returned with a pair of gas masks. Slinging these over their shoulders, the pair descended through the steel hatch into the lower half of the chamber. Down there, the gate glared on them from where it hung suspended, weightless in the centre of spherical space. Reaching the bottom of the steel ladder, Luchov stepped carefully down between the gaping mouths of the circular shafts, cutting at all angles into the giant stone bowl of the floor. These were the wormholes, energy channels which had been eaten through the solid granite in the first seconds of the Perchosk accident, while previously rigid matter had taken on the consistency of dough.
Watch how you go,
he called up to the young major,
and give a wide berth to wormholes with their radiation seals intact. They're still a little hot. Of course you'd know all about that sort of thing, wouldn't you?
He set out to negotiate the perfectly smooth, cold stone floor, following corrugated rubber steps which had been laid down to provide for a firmer tread. And climbing away from the hub, they were soon obliged to use iron rungs where these had been grafted onto a sloping floor, which gradually curved into the vertical, which was also when Luchov drew level with a 3-foot diameter shaft whose lead-lined manhole seal had been left standing open. He'd first spotted the open hatch as he came down the ladder and guessed that this was where Cezanne had been working. For corroboration, a pocket torch with the maintenance engineer's name scratched on its plastic casing lay where Cezanne had left it in the wormhole's gaping mouth. Luchov took up the torch and, lighting the way ahead, he crawled into the hole.
Still interested, are you?
His almost sardonic voice echoed back to the major, who followed on hands and knees.
Good, but if I were you, I'd put on your gas mask.
Cezanne had left a rope attached to the last rung. It snaked out of sight into the wormhole, which wound first to the left, then tilted into a gentle descent for maybe 30 feet before levelling out and finally turned sharply right into darkness, into the permanent midnight of a place long abandoned.
In the old days,
Luchov breathed, where he pierced the smoky darkness with a shaft of light and lowered himself carefully to the lumpy, uneasy-feeling floor,
they used to service the pile from down here.
His voice, mask-muffled, had become a susurrating echo.
But of course, that was before the pile ate itself.
The young officer was close behind, clambering awkwardly out of the wormhole. He stood up and caught hold of Luchov's smock to steady himself. But Luchov was pleased to note that the major's hand shook and his breathing was a little panicked. Probably from the unaccustomed exertion, indeed mainly from that, until Luchov let the beam of the torch creep across the walls, the floor, the magma's inhabitants of the place. Then the major's breathing turned to panting, and his shaking got a lot worse, until after a while he gasped, "My God!" Luchov stepped carefully, fastidiously, over the anonymous and yet homogeneous debris, over the debris which had tried to be homogeneous anyway.
"When the accident happened," he said, "matter became very flexible and flowing, a melting pot without the heat. Oh, there was some heat, a lot in places, but that was mainly chemical reaction or nuclear residual. It had little to do with the way rock, rubber, plastic, metal, flesh and bones melted together into this. This was a different sort of heat, an alien sort, the result of the forging of the gate. As you can see, things get tangled at the crossroads of the universes."
Abruptly, his slithering torch beam passed over and immediately returned to something in the wall. Cezanne's cyst, a fine eggshell sheath of magma stone, like a man-sized blister clinging there, but broken open now and dripping black stuff on the nightmarish floor. Even with their masks filtering out any poisons, still they could smell it. Their movements and Luchov's muffled, echoing voice had disturbed it. As they stared, so sticky,